I wanted to start just by taking us back to last night's vision of Amitabha. So, sun is setting over the vast expanse of ocean. The sun is a sort of burning red, orangey red. And the reflection across the sea is golden. The sky itself is surrounded by this sort of red light. And floating on the ocean is this great, great open red lotus. And seated upon the lotus is the Buddha of the Western realm, Amitabha, a deep red, a ruby red in color. Holding up the lotus. And a very sort of light holding, once again, a very light holding. There's no strain. And all that sort of comes from this vision is, it's just a complete softening. It's a complete warmth. There's absolutely nothing to hold, nothing to protect, nothing to hide. You're in the presence of a Buddha when you see Amitabha like this. So when Bante saw this vision, in the mountain, it's what led him to seek ordination. He left the mountain and went, seeked full bhikkhu ordination. So I think that's quite significant in a way. In a sense, like, again, there's this vision, and then there's how it's played out in life. And for our movement, that vision is significant. For the whole of Triratna, that vision is significant because, well, its continuing unfoldment has led to the creation of Triratna. It wouldn't have existed if not for that vision. But I wanted to follow on with Amitabha. As you heard in the Sukhavati-Vyuha Sutra last night, he's also called Amitayus. So Amitabha is the Buddha of infinite light. Amitayus is the Buddha of infinite life. And the two are, one is, Amitayus is the reflex of the other. So you've got kind of, it's like almost like the other side of the coin in a certain way. And sometimes there were just two names for one Buddha, and sometimes they actually became depicted separately. So Amitayus would be depicted in bodhisattva form, holding a vase, sort of nectar, ambrosia, that sort of gives eternal life. And for me, that again, that connection has always been significant because I've always connected Amitabha very well, directly, with metta, with love. This radiating out of love or of warmth to the highest possible pitch. But then you've got the flip of that is life. Is life, infinite life. It's like metta brings out life. I don't know if you can go as far as to say metta is life, but it certainly it draws up life, it draws out life, it brings it alive. And you can see this very directly on retreat and amongst people actually. It's been one of the delights of living at Padmaloka is that you just like you see like a whole bunch of people come in at the start and they look a bit tired, a bit, you know, work's been hard or something, the family's been a pain or whatever's been going on, and then they leave it, and like the atmosphere is just wonderful. You know, people are bright, their eyes have got that sort of glimmer, and they're all sort of loosened up and softened and like joking with each other. But you can see that on a very individual basis as well. Like, I remember a while ago, one time in the kitchen, when I have no idea what he said, but Pranya Radaya, I think I was feeling a bit mopey or something, Pranya Radaya came up to me and just said something really kind. And I just literally, the light in his eyes got brighter as he said it. You know, quite literally, it's like skillful action, metta, you know, brings out your life, quite literally. The Amitayus meditation is often thought of as a long life practice. You know, you do it for long life. But yeah, I wanted to read a couple of bits about metta. Firstly, what Sangharakshita has got to say, then a list of qualities of metta. But firstly, Sangharakshita. So, love is in fact far too weak a word for the positive counterpart of non-killing or non-violence. And even Maitri, Pali metta, is not altogether satisfactory. Just as killing represents the absolute negation of another person's being, love, as we must perforce to call it, represents its absolute affirmation. As such, it is not erotic love or parental love or even friendly love. If it is love at all, it is a cherishing, protecting, maturing love, which has the same kind of effect on the spiritual being of others as the light and heat of the sun have on their physical being. And in the Pali Canon, this is a wonderful list in a way, because I don't know, I really like it, because in a way it's a bit, you know, it goes a bit outside of our ordinary rational thinking. So, bhikkhus, when the liberation of the mind by loving kindness has been pursued, developed and cultivated, made a vehicle and basis, carried out, consolidated and properly undertaken, 11 benefits are to be expected. What 11? 1. One sleeps well. 2. One awakens happily. 3. One does not have bad dreams. 4. One is pleasing to human beings. 5. One is pleasing to spirits. 6. Deities protect one. 7. Fire, poison, and weapons do not injure one. 8. One's mind quickly becomes concentrated. 9. One's facial complexion is serene. 10. One dies unconfused. And 11. If one does not penetrate further, one fares on to the Brahma world. When, bhikkhus, the liberation of the mind by loving kindness has been repeatedly pursued, developed and cultivated, made a vehicle and basis, carried out, consolidated and properly undertaken, these 11 benefits are to be expected. I think that's pretty good, really. So I particularly like the bit about, you know, weapons won't harm you. It's just like we're talking, like the degree to which one can cultivate metta, you know. It sort of, again, it goes beyond our sort of rational understanding. And you actually hear stories of this, like I remember hearing a story of a Thai monk. I had a friend who was a Thai monk for 10 years in Thailand, and he knew, you know, their elder, and there was some conflict going on. And an RPG, rocket propelled grenade, came through the window and just fell on the floor. Didn't go off or anything. It's like, you know, whether that's true or not, I don't mind really. I just really like it. But I think in a way metta, like as practitioners of the spiritual life, metta, positive emotion, broadly speaking, metta specifically, is vital for us. In some ways, it's our lifeblood. You know, we cultivate it in meditation, but we have to take it off the cushion. We have to take it outside. You know, and that is the realm of friendship in a way. That's where that comes in. I mean, the Buddha says whether we stand, walk, sit or lie down, as long as he is awake, he should develop this mindfulness. This, they say, is the noblest living here. So I wanted to just quickly run through, I'm already almost at my time, I realise, but I'll try and speed up a bit. I want to run through some personal reflections on how to take this into our life more concretely. So the first stage of metta, self, metta towards oneself. I think there are a number of sort of just very practical, very simple things that we can and in a way should do. And for some people, these might just seem quite obvious, but I realise for me they haven't been. Look after yourself properly. Get enough sleep. Eat enough food. Wash. Look after your personal hygiene. Take good care of yourself. Basically, this is really important. Look after yourself. Like, you are a living being, so you need to look after yourself. You're not excluded from that. Yeah. You're not special in that way. You're one of the all beings. the happiness of all beings. Present yourself well. I mean, I think this is different for different people in some way. Like we live with a man called Padmasagar, and he's sort of looking into kind of living a very simple and sort of pared back, sort of more renunciate lives, who wears very simple clothing. I think in some ways, well, for me personally, buying like decent clothes has been like a step towards self-metta in a certain way. It sounds a bit bizarre, but not wearing like really old raggedy things and feeling a bit like bad as a result of it has actually been a step. So yeah, like, look good. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that. But also, just to take it this a little bit deeper, something about caring about yourself is maintaining your own integrity, maintaining your ethical integrity, actually. And this is where it starts sort of broadening out from just self-concern, because actually, you need to be clear on what your values in life are and how you're living them out if you want to be able to maintain your ethical integrity and have a decent sense of yourself that you're living like a good life. This is really important, because I experience a lot of self-doubt and anxiety, really. So just reminding myself, no, I'm trying to live out my values here. I'm making an effort, and I don't hit them all the time, but I am making an effort. Unskillful action, unethical action is degrading. It's humiliating in a way. So, be kind to yourself by maintaining your ethical integrity, in a sense. And another thing, like, happiness is actually important. This seems obvious, but I was reading something by Bhante earlier, a little while ago, where he says, like, happiness is beneficial. You know, it's like, actually, you know, it is important to be happy. You know, it's, I mean, I think I've almost had an attitude for a little while, partly because I had, you know, quite a difficult time at university and in my late teens. I had a time where I just thought, you know, actually, I'm not going to think about happiness right now, I'm just going to survive in a certain sense. But actually it's really important, you know, your Dharma life will dry out if there's not happiness. And you won't draw people, you won't attract people to the Dharma life either, that's the other thing. Following on from that, don't do self-hatred. Just don't do it. Like, it's not good at all. In fact, it just needs to be utterly purged from your system. You're not so special that you deserve to suffer or be hated whilst everyone else gets meta. So just get rid of it. Don't do it. Yeah. And lastly, serve something higher. Know that your life has a bigger perspective so that at the end of the day, it doesn't just fall back on you. This is quite important, really. So the second stage, in a way, I think the second stage is about friendship. Practice friendship. We need to practice friendship. Like, make friends. It doesn't matter how you do it, but do it. Some people, like, this comes naturally. But people make friends in different ways as well. I think it's one of the fantastic things about the movement is that you stick around long enough and it will just happen. Because you just keep bumping into the same people again and again. So it does, you build up shared experience. I remember that time we were on that funny retreat where that Amitabha Puja happened and da-da-da-da-da, so it happens. And share your life, in a way. The one of the best things about friendship is that you can share your life. The things you enjoy, the things you delight in, do them with friends. Take part in common projects, whether it's Dharma teaching, working together, or just building something if you're handy with building things. I don't know. have a common project. In a way, again, this comes back to ethics and practicing the precepts, because the precepts are always in relation to people. So you practice the precept in the relation to your friends, love, generosity, even contentment, truthful speech, mindfulness, they all lead to friendship, like good friendship. The other thing about friendship is that it helps you to draw it, like you draw out the best in other people and they draw out the best in you. So you need that too. You need that. There's so much more I could say about friendship. You can give like whole long talks. We can give series of talks on friendship. And, people have, Subhuti has. It's worth looking at that. They're very good. But it's one of the greatest delights of life, if not the greatest delight of life, friendship at its best, in a way, because it just keeps going. Spiritual friendship, good friendship. Moving on to the third stage, the neutral stage. Well, the world consists mostly of neutral people. There's a lot of people we don't know and we have no connection with. So we need to take what we've sort of developed in the second stage, we need to take that out, we need to spread it out, because in a way there are a lot of lonely people in the world, a lot of lonely kind of lost people. So we need to offer what we've been given, what we've created to other people. Take interest in others, even if they seem boring, that usually changes as you talk to them. The great thing about the neutral stage and sort of getting interested in people is that you realize that every person has something that they live for. Every person has sort of like this thread in their life which is important, the golden thread, as it were. And if you find that, then in a way you've tapped into their sort of being. And something happens when you do that. It sort of enriches your own life in a way, because you can see how another form that life can take. You can see, well, it's enriching. So moving on to the fourth stage, usually the difficult person. I mean, the main thing I want to say here, because I'm over time, is just don't give up on people. Never give up on people in a certain sense. No person should ever be written off. I mean, sometimes you do need to, sometimes you need to have distance from people, physically, even mentally, you know, if there's something, you know, particularly painful, even damaging that's happened. But I think if you're taking your Dharma life seriously and you're going deeper, like at some point you kind of, in some point and in some way, you have to begin to look at these things, because we can't hold grudges in the spiritual life. They're like poison, basically. They just sit in your heart. They don't go. But the other thing is that aversion, ill will, hatred, it's like a big arrow pointing at your ego. Yeah, it's sort of like... you have to, like... It's an opportunity as well. Like, if you can look at it kindly, patiently, it's like, well, yeah, we're silly things in a way. We're very unenlightened sometimes, a lot of the time. So don't worry. But when you really look at this stage and come into sort of contact with these people and really, you know, work at developing metta to them, it can, something quite magical can happen. Because you can sort of, it can actually flip. I mean, this has definitely been my experience. People that I had like borderline traumatic times with, I've put in my metta bhavana for over long periods of time, and actually, you realize that they're human. Yeah, of course, they're human, and there was a lot going on there. There were certain pressures, there were certain conditions, there were certain things that led to them acting in particular ways. And you know, chances are it was very painful for them as well. So yeah, it can be a basis to develop compassion as well. But the other thing is, ill will is often a result of something that we're trying to avoid in ourselves. So when we face it, we can actually liberate something within ourselves. We can, either get a better perspective or like get rid of any guilt or fear around it or something like that. We can, yeah, it's sort of an integration practice in a certain way. That's why it's so important to be in practicing within a sangha, because you will come up against people that you don't like one way or another. And the fifth stage, lastly, just keep doing it. Keep doing it. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, practice metta. Practice it at work, practice it with your family, practice it with old friends, practice it with new friends. Wherever you go, maintain this attitude. Like, don't split your values into, don't split yourself into, basically. Be a person that generates metta all the time. I mean, it's a tall order, but it's what we're aiming for, it's what we're going for. And Bhante said that the reason he practiced the Dharma was because he believed that friendship was possible with any other human being. And this is the attitude that we want to try and have in a way. I mean, it may seem like a long way off, but we can at least be moving towards that. So yeah, the metta bhavana is a big practice. It's a huge practice. In fact, in some ways, it's the practice. It leads all the way to enlightenment itself. I mean, if you can identify completely with another being, know their life as you know your own, and cherish their life as you cherish your own, then basically that barrier between self and other is gone. You know, it's gone. And if this is the case with all beings, if you can maintain that with all beings, then you're a free man. You're a free man. So yeah. I think when we've like to have encountered a practice like a metta bhavana, I think we're sort of blessed in a certain way. We've encountered something utterly precious, utterly precious. So just don't ever stop doing it, really. Yeah. Thank you.